else we had. But for now, verse 7, page 1089. And to the angel of the church in Philadelphia write these things, says he who is holy, says he who is true, he who has the key of David, he who opens and no one shuts, and shuts and no one opens. I know your works. See, I have set before you an open door, and no one can shut it, for you have a little strength, have kept my word, and have not denied my name. Indeed, I will make those of the synagogue of Satan, who say they are Jews and not, but lie, indeed, I will make them come and worship before your feet, and to know that I have loved you. Because you have kept my command to persevere, I also will keep you from the hour of trial which will come upon the whole world to test those who dwell on the earth. Behold, I am coming quickly. Hold fast what you have, that no one may take your crown. He who overcomes, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go out no more. I will write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the new Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven from my God, and I will write on him my new name. He who has an ear to hear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. Well, you all understand that, so I don't need to say any more. So, why are we into this? Well, it's the third part, really, of we've been looking two previous Thursday nights. If you weren't here, why not? At encouraging things for little churches, and this is really the third part of that series, if you like. So, a question for you. You may know this. Do you know Bexley is twinned with another two places? Does anybody know who Bexley is twinned? Oh, nodding in the back. Give me one. Every. And where's Every? Well done. That was since 1971. Who else knows? Do you know both? No. Anyone else?
Pete.
Pete? Oh dear. It's embarrassing, isn't it? The other one is Arnsberg, and you'll have noticed there's Arnsberg Way, and I've never realised what the link was, but Arnsberg, which is in Germany, and it has been twinned since a very famous year. It's Arnsberg in Germany. Which year do you think that we were? 1966. I wonder why they did that, eh? That's all an embarrassment for the Germans. So tonight we're going to do a bit of twinning of our own. We're going to twin Belvedere with Philadelphia in Asia Minor. The aim of twinning, what is it? I think it's twofold. One, to work together, and two, to learn from each other. It's going to be a little bit difficult to work together with a city that existed 2,000 years ago, but I hope we can learn a little bit from Philadelphia, the church. Revelation has got, let's ask. Over the back. Anyone over the back who's intelligent? How many letters were written to churches in Revelation? That's a bit much. It's easy.
You said it was mean.
Mean? All right. Well, how many letters for the adults were there written to churches in Revelation? Oh! Were you whispered to? No, well done. Good answer. And which letter was the letter to the Philadelphians out of those seven? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Now you can guess this. It wasn't 1, 2, or 3, and there are seven. So guess a number.
4.
Not 4. That was a good guess. We'll whip them away. Yes, you're good at numbers. 5. No, it wasn't 5. 6. I've heard that twice. 6. Well done. 2 girls got it right. So, the 6th letter. So, this is sort of applicable to you as well, maybe more to the boys. For those of you who have read Thomas the Tank Engine, you will recall he tried to get up steep inclines and he'd puff and puff and puff and the steam would come out. And what did he sound like? It sounded like he was saying, I think it was Thomas the Tank Engine, you'll prove me wrong. Was it another train?
I don't know.
This train went up the steep incline and it went... And it sounded like, I can do it, I can do it, I can do it.
What's that, James?
Or Thomas? I don't know. It was a train. Anyway, I can do it, I can do it, I can do it. And it sounded like it was puffing away. Well, I remember, and you might remember this place, or is it still up? I don't think it's still up. When we were at school, that was a long time ago, there was a place called St Martin's Grove.
Does anyone know St Martin's Grove?
Not the older ones.
Is it still there? Still there. Is it still open?
It had a swimming pool. And when it had a swimming pool, I wasn't even keen on getting in the water then and doing anything else. It wasn't hot enough. And we would have lessons and I'd never achieve anything. And then one day someone got on the other side of the swimming pool and said, give you a bag of crisps if you can get over, swim to the other side. Only the short side, wasn't the long side. And I did. So there was a lesson for me. Yes, I can do it if there's a reward at the other end. Could have been chocolate, could have been anything. But I managed to get over one whip. That's about as far as I've managed now, so it hasn't improved much. But it's a bit like this letter. Jesus is like a father here, encouraging his children along the path of life. Of all of the letters, seven of them, most of them are full of condemnation of people, isn't it? Of Jesus saying to the churches, you're not good enough. Take out the big words. So you're not good enough. But this letter is different. It's an encouragement. And from verse 8, it appears that it's written to a little church because it says you have little strength. So it's an encouraging letter. It's to a little church. We're not a very big church. So it's an encouraging letter to us. This isn't an extensive Bible study because it's me doing it, but we're going to have a look at a few things which hopefully will encourage us by the end. So three sort of basic points, but there's a lot of bits coming in between. Who wrote the letter? What are the opportunities that they had? And what was their ultimate security? So, someone guess who's littler than 20. Who wrote this letter to the church at Philadelphia? It begins with a J. And it ends in an S. Oh, come on. It's got another few letters in it.
Sorry.
It's easy. There is no trick. It's the letter by Jesus to the church. It's written a letter of Revelation, it's written by John, but it's Jesus wrote the letters to the churches. So, most of us, if not all, know that, I guess, as I'm beginning to wonder. But it's important, isn't it? This is a letter. It's in the big book, but it started as a letter, sort of. And if we get letters, what sort of letters can we get? You may be not big enough to get many letters, but some letters, your parents stick them on the side and don't open them because they really don't want to see what's inside. What sort of letters are they? Bills. Well done. Your voice has got a lot deeper. Bills. So we don't like those ones. What other sort of letters can we get? Comes in with pictures of round things with pepperoni on. What?
Love letters.
Pizza. Well, John gets love letters now. Here comes coming in. Yes, what? Invitations. Well, they're good letters. I wasn't thinking of those yet. But we get junk mail. We get bills. Some. Oh, yes. Letters from. Do you have pen pals? Oh, I never had any friends. You're very lucky. Right. Letters from pen pals. They're good letters. And sometimes,
threatening
letters when you haven't paid the bill to put aside. And sometimes you get a check, that's nice, because that's money to bank. And sometimes you get something even more important, like a season ticket to Charlton come in the post. And sometimes you get letters from family members or pen pals. So this letter is therefore very, very important because it comes from the head of the church. And if you're Christians, then it comes from your brother as well, Jesus, the brother of Christians. So, at the very start, Jesus reminds them that he wrote the letter and explains why he has the authority to send it. And if you look up those verses that we did look at, we won't rush around lots of places, but in Revelation 3, he describes himself in a number of ways. So at the very start, he wants them to know who's writing the letter. And it says to the angel of the church. We think that really means to the pastor of the church in Philadelphia. These things says he who is holy. So he's described as a holy one. The holy one's a phrase that the Jews would certainly have known about. Isaiah was a prophet. He wrote about this often in chapter 1, verse 4, and chapter 5, verse 19. He talked of the Holy One of Israel. It was also known to the demons. And you might think, well, don't think about demons, but the Bible says there are demons. And there was one very special one where demons were cast out, and they said, don't do this, you're the Holy One of God. Now, do you remember that story? They went into the pigs, and the pigs ran down into the slope. So even the demons recognised Jesus is the Holy One. But it also says something else. It says he who is holy, and he who is true. Now, if you've got friends, do you like friends who tell you the truth, or do you like friends who tell you lies?
Only lies.
You'd rather have those. I think you're not unique. You are unique, yeah. So, the true one. In an age where we're concerned about false religions, and we're very much in the sort of situation that they were in here, they had lots of false religions. We look around now, we see lots of false religions. When you're in that situation, you're very glad to have someone who tells you the truth. And I think when you're little, you'll very quickly learn there's a lot of people try and mislead you. There's people who sound as if they know a lot of things, and in reality they don't know much at all. So don't be misled by adults who you think are very, very self-important, who seem to know lots of things. Sometimes not true. And then he's something else as well. He says at the end of that verse, he who has the key of David. Now, what on earth does that mean? That means that he's royal, he's a king, and he's got authority over his kingdom. And again, there's a link into the Old Testament. So if you find people at school or anywhere else saying the Old Testament doesn't really matter, most of the time bits of the New Testament refer back to things in the Old Testament. So you've got to have both bits together. And this is what was said in Isaiah 22, verse 20-22, there's a man called Eliakim. Eliakim was referred to as owning the key of the house of David. It meant he had complete control. It wasn't David that he was actually looking after, that's a phrase. He was actually looking after King Hezekiah. And he had this key, and it meant that if you wanted something, you'd go and see Eliakim, because he was able to give it to you, because Hezekiah had said, you can do that for him. And if you wanted to go and see Hezekiah, you'd go and see Eliakim and you'd say, please can I go and see Hezekiah the king? And if Eliakim said yes, then you got in to see the king. So, it's a bit the same today, isn't it? There's a parallel to Jesus. If we want to know who's got authority, he's the one who owns the king's keys to the King of David. If we want to approach God the Father, we need to go through Jesus, the one who holds the keys to the kingdom. So, he's the Holy One, he's the true one, he's the possessor of the key of David, therefore this is a letter we should be looking at, I think. And then there's one more thing. He was also the chief steward. So, let's imagine that you are the believers in Philadelphia. I don't know much about Philadelphia, and I'm sure you probably don't know that much more than I do. You may be wrong. But we don't know where the believers came from. They may have been scattered out of Jerusalem, so they may have been what nationality people. It begins with J and ends in S, and it's not Jesus. Jews. Okay. So, they were possibly Jews. Now, imagine in your mind's eye that you're in those early days of the Christian church starting out. You've been used to being Jews,
and all of a sudden you start putting your trust in Jesus, you become a Christian, how would you have felt? Probably a bit of an outcast. You would have worshipped where? Where did the Jews used to worship?
In the
synagogue. Well done. So you'd have worshipped in the synagogue, and then you'd have had to have moved out eventually into a house, maybe, and eventually to a church. So you were in the synagogue, you left, you became a Christian. How do you think some of the Jews felt about it? You thought you were a traitor, so you turn to Christ and you're rejected, maybe by your friends, maybe by your family, and probably outcast by the church that you used to be in the synagogue. So we come to this person who's also the chief steward of the church, so therefore a very important person to give us the letter. So Jesus offers sympathy and tells the believers in this little church, it doesn't matter what other people think of them, it only matters what Christ thinks. And that gives us one question to take home. When we come to that final day, and the Bible tells us there's going to be a final day for all of us, there will be a judging, what will Christ say to you about how you've lived your life? Question to think in your mind. And then he's the head of the church. Well, whose church is it anyway? As we've said in previous Bible studies, there needs to be balance in this. It's not the minister's church, although we've experienced times where maybe people think it is the minister's church. It's not the people's church. No matter whether you've been here a month or 50 years, it's not your church as such. It is Christ's church. It's not the member's church, Christ's church. But don't think that membership isn't important. You can still say, I'm a member of the church in Belvedere. You just don't own the church for yourself. So we're members, but let's not lose focus of whose church we ultimately belong to. So, they had opportunities. What opportunities did they have? If you've done business studies, you do business studies yet, and a bit young for business studies, you come across something called a SWOT. And that's not someone who does lots and lots of studying, is always in the library. It's strengths, weaknesses, opportunities and threats. Yeah? And you can look at every issue in business and say, what are the strengths of that? What are the weaknesses? What are the opportunities? What are the threats? Well, there's a couple of those bits in this passage. It doesn't talk about strengths, but I think we ought to mention that. We've got lots of strengths in this church. We might be fairly small, but I believe we've got lots and lots of strengths. We've got a great mix of ages. Check it out. Lots of young and a few who are older, and some that are in the middle. I'm not sure which bit I'm now fitting, but I think I'm getting into the older bunch. So some who would be glad to have families in their church would be quite envious of us as a church. Some who would love to have the wisdom of age and have only got younger people. So we've got great strength. We've had solid Bible teaching for many years, so that's a great strength. We reach about 100 young people every week. Some are our own children, some are from families of several children, but that must mean at least 35 homes every week that we reach as a church. There's strength. We've learned from past years how easily trouble can arise in a church, so maybe that's made us more cautious. We've hopefully learned from experience what's of the most importance and what's secondary in Christian life. So we've got some strengths, not mentioned in this passage, I just wanted to get balance. And there are threats. Oh, sorry, one thing. Just imagine Joshua's victory. This came in this morning's Swindoll sermon on radio. I thought that's quite useful. That was going, but I'd already typed up. So, when Joshua went for victory at a little place called Ai, he'd been to Jericho and moves on to Ai. And lots of people there had different roles. Some were going to go to the front gates and say, and then run away. And some were going to wait round the back and were going to come in later and defeat the people of Ai. There was no jealousy. It wasn't, I want to be the ones at the front, I want to be the ones at the back. They all worked together to get the plan together. So that's what we need to do. So there are some threats for us. These threats often come from inside a church. And we heard recently of a church where the minister fell out with some of the congregation and asked some to come to the front and said to them, "You're welcome here," and said to the people at the back, "You're not at all welcome." Well, that's not the way we want the church. Chuck this morning said that he was at a conference, and at the conference he had someone burst in the doors, and the person said, "You're doing everything wrong. You shouldn't be doing that. You've got that teaching wrong." And they gradually ushered him out. And apparently they found out later this man thought his ministry was to reprove people. Well, wouldn't we rather have people who are encouragers rather than reprovers? So whilst we've got no under-shepherd, we need to be careful. The threat is that we somehow get bits of teaching that aren't quite right. I don't think we'll ever get it from the pulpit, but we may find things that we think, and there isn't someone necessarily to lead us in the right way. We've got to be worried about the threat of egos. It's very easy, isn't it? I am important. We've seen that in churches. I've got the money. I can do what I like. We've got to be careful about negativity. I am a reprover. It's very easy to knock people. It's not so easy to encourage them. And then be concerned about the threat that someone else will do it. There's this little poem, isn't there? We all thought someone was going to do it, but eventually no one did it. So those are two bits that are not really in this passage. So I sort of added to the passage, but didn't. Nothing nasty. So there are opportunities. Let's have a look at verse 8. "I know your works. See, I have set before you an open door, and no one can shut it. For you have little strength, have kept my word, have not denied my name." So I've set before you an open door. Just imagine you are one of those Jews that are marching around Jericho. You all know this story. So they turn up and they see this city and it's got great big walls around it. And God says to Joshua, "This is what you're going to do to defeat Joshua." "Yeah, I'm going to walk around it once. I'm going to walk around it six times. I'm going to walk around it seven times." And he thinks, "Am I really going to go and tell the people this?" So he turns up and he says to the people, "This is how we're going to defeat Jericho." "Yeah! We're going to walk around it once and we're going to..." They had to believe that it was the way that God wanted for them to approach this. And they did. So the challenge for us is, what would he say to us? Would he say, "You have kept my word and not denied my name"? And what is the open door that was open to them? Well, the door, it seems, is a door for service and for evangelism. It's not unique to Revelation. Paul uses the phrase as well. So 1 Corinthians 16, if we have the time to look it up, he says he won't stay in Ephesus because there's a great door for effective work which has opened up to me. So he uses this term of a door. If doors that are open, it means that there is an easy way, well, not an easy way, a way opened up for something to happen. And again, he uses it in when he urges the church in Colossae to pray that God will open a door for our message so that we may proclaim the mystery of Christ. So Paul recognises there's this open door. Back to our opening thoughts. Jesus had already opened up the door. He is saying, "You can do it." Thomas the Tank Engine or whoever it was, "You can do this. I've opened up the door for you already." Why does he need to encourage them? Because as yet they haven't gone through the door. It's been open for a while. They didn't feel able to go through. So, there's a story of a pastor in America. You're very good. We can't use this story here for here. He'd got a big church in America and he was new to the church and it was very struggling. And there were only a handful of people. And where do you think they sat? At the back, right at the back. So what he did the next week, once he'd come in the first week and see them all at the back, I don't think it was like this, I presume it was a lectern. He took the lectern and marched it up to within 2 paces of where they were sitting and preached his sermon. And the next week, you know what, there were another row full up. So he took the lectern, he moved it back a row, and by the end of the first couple of years, because of his enthusiasm, the fact that he saw this open door in this place, lots of people outside, not from the inside, the lectern was back on the stage where it belonged. So encouragement, when there is opportunity, can mean that the church grows. So, what were the weaknesses then? We've seen opportunities. What was the weakness? It's in that verse 8. No one can shut it. You have little strengths. Eh? They had a little strength. What does it mean? I can't necessarily tell you because it doesn't tell us. It says there's little strength. Maybe they were low in numbers. Maybe they were elderly. Maybe they were physically not terribly strong. Maybe they were worried about a lack of money. Maybe they were worried about limited gifts that they perceived they had. Maybe they thought they haven't got enough pairs of hands to do the work. Jesus said, I've opened the door, I'll provide you with the resources. He has the resources, he has the ultimate authority. We've already seen that at the start. Jesus says, when we are faithful, he will be faithful in return. So what stopped them then? We find it in verse 9. And it really comes in two ways. So first off, verse 9, self-doubt. I will make those of the synagogue of Satan who say they are Jews and are not, but lie. Indeed, I will make them come worship before you. So, this synagogue of Satan, what on earth does it mean? If the Jews were Jews and they used to be in the synagogue, and they've been chucked out, suggestion, I think, is that the synagogue of Satan is those religious leaders who were going to oppress them. So they didn't like them leaving. There's religious opposition, and the mention of the synagogue seems to imply that the Jews resented the conversions, the fact that Christians had come from it. So what were they saying? We used to be part of a nice, big, strong synagogue, didn't we? And now look at you. You're weak. You're not liked. God must have turned his back on you. So there's doubt in their mind. Why are we in this situation? Why are we of little strength? Who's behind the lies? Clearly Satan. But look at the response of the head of the church. I will make them worship before your feet and make them know that I have loved you. What happens when you doubt things? So, you're in the exam and you think, I've learnt all of this. Then you get in there and you look at question number one and it's not one of the things you learn. So, having had this doubt in your mind, what comes next? Begins with F. Yes? Give me a word.
Fear.
Fear, well done. So, after the self-doubt, there was fear. It's a bit like when I was at school, we used to have glasses, and often those nasty people from down the road, the other school, up the road, they used to come and taunt us, and I had a friend also had glasses, and they'd say, oh, specs, specs, specs. And you get to think, oh, I'm a bit worried now, and I'm very fearful of what's going to happen. We know from Revelation that the opposition will get worse in this life. Don't get worried about this. It tells us it's going to come, but we will be protected. So, worse and worse. Well, who do we hear about? There are people in the back end of Revelation. There's one called the Beast. Government-sponsored persecution is effectively what he stands for. And aren't we seeing that at the moment? Yet again this week. All of those cases were thrown out in European court, Christians who had a reason to have their faith protected and the government backed forces saying, no, nope, we're not going to protect you. That will come. And then there's the false prophet. Well, how much false religion do we need in this country? There's plenty of it around already and it'll probably get worse. So when we doubt, then we fear, then we shrink back from being effective because we say we can't evangelize and then we say, we'll water down the word because we'll upset someone. Well, we mustn't be doing that, must we? So Jesus says, keep on. And it says in verse 10, because you have kept my command to persevere, I also will keep you. So what are we afraid of? Persecution? Ridicule? Maybe even failure? If I do that, I'm never going to get it right. Well, that's not the response. Remember the parable of the talents? Wasn't the one who necessarily made the most money, it was the one who determined that he was going to do something with the talents. So, very quickly then, what is our ultimate security? So we say, the head of church writes to us, he encourages us, he says there's a door that's open, what are we going to do about it? Are we going to go through the door? Is he going to give us the strength? Yes, he is. And what do we see in the last couple of verses? So
verse 11. He says there's going to be a reward. Behold, I am coming quickly. Hold fast what you have, that no one takes away your crown. A crown awaits in heaven for all the faithful. Those who've been laughed at on earth will be applauded in heaven. There are clearly degrees of reward. I'm sure you've heard the story before. The same time Whitfield and Wesley were ministering, and Whitfield encouraged Wesley to minister, and then towards the end of their time, someone walks up to Wesley and says, "Will you see Whitfield in heaven?" He said, "Oh no, I won't see Whitfield in heaven." And he says, "He'll be far, far in advance of me, right near the throne. I'll never see him that far away." And that's a response to us, isn't it? There will be degrees of reward, but there is a certainty, there's a reward for everyone who is faithful. And verse 12, "He who overcomes, I will make a pillar in the temple of my God." Now you might think being a pillar in the temple doesn't sound terribly exciting, but without the pillar, you're in a dangerous position here. What happens? The whole lot falls down, doesn't it? So A, it's in the temple, it's near to God. B, it's very, very useful. So being made a pillar of the temple is quite remarkable, even essential. Service is not unimportant or indispensable. Jesus applauds service for him. How do you feel when the boss compliments you? Pretty good. How do you feel if you were mentioned in the New Year's honours? I guess pretty good. That quite happened yet. I'm sure it might happen one day. What do you do when Jesus commends you for your service to him? It will seem a million times better, wouldn't it? And then what about ownership? We are not our own. The Bible's pretty clear about that often. So let's read the rest of verse 12. "I will make him a pillar in the temple. He shall go out no more. I will write on him the name of my God, the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem, which comes out of heaven from my God. I will write on him my new name." So we will get, you've got to have names, haven't you? You lot are far more up to it than me, but if you're on Facebook, you will need a password, won't you? When we used to go to school, I don't know whether you still do this, you would get given your exercise book, and apart from having to put plastic around it, which all screws up and you throw it away six times because it doesn't lay flat, what else do you do when you first get your exercise book? Maybe you don't anymore. Maybe you don't have exercise book. What's the right name on it? Name on it, yeah. So that shows it's my exercise book. It's got my name on it. Password for bank accounts or Facebook pages, it shows it's your Facebook page, and you hope that no one could break into it. There are even people who used to write their names on pencil bags together with their favourite football team. I'm not mentioning any names, but it used to be Leeds. And, you know, we have ways of identifying things as ours, and Jesus says to us, if you're faithful to me, you'll get my name, the name of God first, the name of God's holy city, Jerusalem, which shows we're citizens of his final kingdom. We'll get the name of Jesus, Messiah, the risen Lord, the victorious Saviour, the Redeemer. What a great name to have. And then, just in conclusion, what about us? We have got gifts, we've said, humanly speaking, we've got gifts. I've been wonderfully blessed by God in various ways. You might think you haven't got talents, but I guarantee you have. But we're still fairly small numerically and in terms of size of the building. So where do we go? We should be encouraged. The letter was written to a little church nearly 2,000 years ago, but it can be applied just as much to us. Just go back to the time of Jericho. You say they walked around. Were the people who walked around soldiers? No, they didn't really talk much. In fact, the only thing they were really good at, they were called nomads. Word, which meant that they wandered. So what did God say to them? You can wander around Jericho. It's a great idea. Use the talents that they've got. And God said, it's my power. It's going to come down from me. It's not going to come down because you've got great strength. I'm going to use your talent and I'm going to achieve my end. That's true of us, isn't it? Take our talent, come to his end. So, we don't answer any human authority.
We should respect those who God has placed over us, but our work will be reviewed by the one who's the head of the church. So, as we come to the end of it, there will be rewards for those who are faithful. We've got talents in this church. Let's be encouraged and go forward with enthusiasm, because the door is open. Right, prayer time. But you're still awake. Just. So, sing.
Sing again.
302.